And welcome to week two. I just want to mention a couple of things before I jump in. One, tonight I'm charged up on a huge glass of coffee. So if I start talking really fast, you'll know why. And because at 8 o'clock, my Atlanta Braves are in the National League division or championship series. So I thought I might teach with my ball cap on tonight in honor of the Braves. And if you're a Dodgers fan, you can stay on the call. You just can't ask questions tonight. So, no, just kidding. Even if you're a Dodgers fan, you can ask questions. But they play at 8:10, and so that fits pretty well with my commitment to have us all out on time at 8 o'clock. I want to start. I want to start really with where we were. Well, last week I was really setting the stage for what I would say is going to get more practical. And I think every week the plan is to get more practical. I was laying some kind of foundational pieces. And I want to just remind you of the story I told. Last week I told you a story about my friend who called me, who wanted me to help his brother escape his skepticism. This is a situation where my friend's other brother had passed away, and his other younger brother had turned away from the church, turned away from faith in college. And one of the things that my friend was emphasizing is that he had no interest to spend their time together in heated debates. That's not what he wanted to do. But he, at the same time, he was telling me he loved his brother too much to just simply passively avoid conversations about God. So he couldn't stand the thought of just settling for passing their days watching college football or talking sports, all the while trying to numb himself to what he confessed he believed, to what he said and believed to be the most important thing in his life, which was his relationship with God in Christ. And although he didn't want to be uncomfortable around his brother, he recognized that there's probably going to be some uncomfortable conversations, but he didn't want those to be knockout dragouts. How do I have this conversation? How do I approach him who's coming now with a very different framework and have a conversation with him? And my bet is, if you showed up for week two, you've experienced something like this, and that's why you're doing this course. You can relate to what my friend was experiencing. I know I have been there and kind of frustrated. How do I enter this conversation, and then where do I go once, Lord willing, we get into it? So I wanted just, again, to give you kind of, okay, where are we headed? At least my aims. What do I want us to achieve at the end of this? And one of the things is to simply engage in conversations about things that really matter. I hope that you left last week and you leave each night inspired to actually go get into some conversations about things that really matter, about meaning and significance. Even if you're not necessarily every time able to link that to the gospel or to Christ, but just to go have significant conversations about hurts and pains and things we're experiencing. I think that's the gateway here, is to be inspired and then intentional about having these conversations that don't settle for just shallow things. I think the other thing to have better conversations, my aim is that we would be people who learn to be winsome. God has chosen us of all people, his church. He's called us, and he's called us to be his ambassadors, which means I'm convinced that what part of this means is we need to think very carefully about how we communicate his message. Now, I believe God is sovereign. I believe that the Spirit works in people's lives to draw them, but I also believe he uses us. And so that's a mystery how all that works, but he uses us. He's chosen to use us. And my bet is most of the people listening, watching this or you know, on video or who's here live, when they have a big presentation that's going to represent their company or their boss, or if they're about to go on stage, if you're an actor or a musician, you give so much attention to what you're going to do. You have a plan, you have a strategy, and you go through that. And then, but I why wouldn't it be the case that with our role as ambassadors, that we give at least as much attention to what we're going to say and a plan and a strategy to think through that? The Spirit can work. Hopefully the Spirit's working. We're praying that the Spirit works even through our course, even through our planning, not simply in the moment when we're talking about talking to somebody. And I believe that we're called to actually think through, how can we talk to people? How can we best persuade them and be winsome? So I hope we come out of this more winsome. And finally, not just to convince them that there is a God or that on any particular issue, this isn't just generally being winsome, but how do we connect these big questions of life to the good news of Jesus? So that's the third thing. So those are the aims: be inspired to have these conversations, learn how to be winsome, and how to connect with this, our conversations up with Jesus. The thing is, to get at number two and number three, to actually get at number two and three, I think a lot of training can kind of focus on one and to inspire you, but to actually be winsome and to actually connect our people's lives up with this message of the gospel, we've got to start with who we're talking to. We've got to think deeply about who it is we're talking to. And what I mean by this is, well, let me tell you what I don't mean by this. What I don't mean by this is, or at least for our time tonight, is what I'm not going to do is take us through, here is Generation Z, or here is a baby boomer, here is somebody, you know, here is an age demographic, and this is how you speak to them. That's not what we're doing. I mean who we're talking to in about as general sense as we can get. I'm talking about humans, okay? We're talking to humans, so we have to think about human nature. So when we're talking to humans, we need to know who we are talking to. What kind of beings are we? And the theological jargon, I'll just tell you on this, is a theological anthropology. So we're thinking, given God's revelation to us, how are we to think about what kind of beings we humans are? So I want to give you 3 points under this kind of part two here in tonight's talk. And that's the first point is, we're holistic storying beings. We're holistic storying beings. What do I mean by that? Well, on one hand, I think one way to break this down is to think about ourselves as humans are thinking beings, we're believing beings, and we're loving beings. We're fundamentally worshiping, doxological beings. And these first two is how a lot of people, especially the first one, when we think about how do I be winsome in this conversation, we often start there, and we might go to, well, there's some things that you have to believe first and then understand. That's Augustine had that famous line where he says, I believe to understand. And so we kind of land on those two aspects of our humanity, that we're thinking beings or people who believe certain things. And I do think that both of those are true and right about humans, and both play a crucial part in our discussions and persuasions and how we make decisions as human beings. However, I think that if we just leave it there, and that's how we view humans as thinking and believing beings, then we actually don't get at the kind of the deep currents of our soul, the things that are actually shaped, or the aspect of who we are as humans that's shaping and guiding us and pushing us towards the decisions we make. We humans are not In other words, we humans are not walking computers. We're not calculating our way through life. Though we are thinking beings, we're not merely thinking beings. I think if we view ourselves as simply thinking beings or simply believing beings, this actually reduces our humanity, and it's going to have an impact on how we talk to people. Just think about the big decisions in your life, the big ones, okay? Who you would marry, what your vocation, what you wanted to do for work, where you would live. And yes, because we're Christians here thinking about it, talk to other people, think about how it is you came to believe God and love God. You didn't reach these decisions that said, yes, I'm going to worship God, I'm going to believe in God, simply by plugging numbers into a calculator in your brain or using logical syllogisms. In other words, you didn't logic chop your way to big decisions. Healthy persuasion, yes, uses logic and evidence, but it also grounds logic and evidence in genuine human connection. And it gives credence to and it resonates with people's deeply held aspirations and affections. In other words, it recognizes that we humans are worshiping beings. We are going to worship something. We're doxological beings. So we're pushed and we're pulled by what we love. I think it's important, even as I give you this kind of, okay, who are we talking to as humans? And I've broken this down into three points here, that you don't see these things as separated. I did that for certain teaching, for reasons, pedagogical reasons as a teacher. I've broken these three things down, but in actuality, they all work together. We don't separate our affections and our beliefs from our rationalizing. We sometimes like to think about that. Sometimes we talk about that. We say things like, well, my heart tells me this, but my brain tells me this, or my reason tells me this. But in actuality, those things are even interwoven. That's just how we work as humans. So I'll cite a non-Christian at this point, just to say, this is what we see in the scriptures. Let me go to the scriptures and then I'll go to a non-Christian. In the scriptures, when the Bible talks about the heart, we often think about, okay, well, that's your emotions. But the way the scripture uses heart, it's using it really as this catch-all that includes our reasoning. It's our will. It's our beliefs. It's the core of who we are. And so they're all connected here together, and that's my point. Now let me quote the non-Christian here. This is the New York University, the NYU social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, and he puts it like this. Oh, I thought I had the quote. Let me just read it to you. He says this: human rationality depends critically on sophisticated emotionality. Human rationality depends on sophisticated emotionality. It is only because our emotional brains work so well that our reasoning can work at all. So what I'm saying here is, this is what we have, this ancient wisdom in the Bible that says, hey, your heart are all of these things and they're connected. And that's how you make decisions. That directs your life. And then you have a clinical social psychologist, a research social psychologist, who's telling us, actually, yes, that's true. That's how we as humans work. And that's really important. It's going to be important affirmation for us as we get into more and more practical things. But we need to kind of put it out here at the beginning. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. The chat room is up and they will come to me. Please send me your questions as you have them. And I'm going to stop rather than save them till the end tonight. I'm going to try to stop a couple times and take some questions depending on how we're doing with time. So please, as I say something, maybe I didn't say it well, maybe you're not understanding or you have some ways you want me to expand this for clarification, please send those questions in as we go through. The second part of this about when we're talking to humans and understanding how humans are is this idea of rationality and social imagination. And I want to define what I mean. First of all, rationality. When we say someone is rational, I want you to think about this. If you say that's a very rational person, or that's a rational decision that they've made, what goes into your conception of rationality? You've likely never have thought of this. The scholars have done work here, and I think they help us a lot, because they'd say really someone's perception about what is rational can be helpfully summarized by three points. First, there's basic logic. So if somebody is saying 1 + 1 = 3, yeah, we have a pretty good reason to say that's not rational. And that's true whether you're in 21st century America or first century Palestine or anything in between. 1 + 1 = 2, or the law of non-contradiction. You can't have a married bachelor. Those two things contradict. This is basic logic. And so that's a pretty much universal kind of understanding that if somebody's not operating with basic logic, then that's not rational. Or if they are, that's part of rationality, a healthy rationality. The second part of this, though, is we perceive whether something's rational, or we determine if someone's being rational based on the evidence available to them. Now, in other words, at different parts of the world, at different times, of course, more evidence was discovered. So we wouldn't say that someone was irrational if they were, 3,000 years ago for believing that the sun rotated around the earth. We wouldn't say that that's irrational. We would say that there was certain evidence that wasn't available to them. And so part of rationality is, okay, what evidence is available? And I think that that's important to understand. Now, what I really want to zero in on, though, is this third component of rationality, because it's really important to where we're going and how we think about having conversations. And that is what has been referred to as our social imagination, or connected to this is an assumed meta-narrative. Now, let me kind of give you what I mean by both of these. First, we'll start with an assumed meta-narrative. This is a meta-narrative. Meta is just talking about, you could call it a mega narrative or a mega story. This is a big story that that speaks to the big questions of life. Now, if you start asking questions, the kind of human questions like, why are we here? How did we get here? What are we supposed to be doing? These are kind of the big philosophical questions that hang over almost everyone, that people start asking if you're human. And once you start asking these kind of very human questions, you find yourself, if you're going to attempt to answer them, you begin to tell a story. You begin to weave a narrative in order to respond to that story, that narrative. Now, so that's the assumed meta narrative. And oftentimes they're assumed. You don't necessarily always think all your way there. You inherit them. And this is a tie to what the philosopher I mentioned in last week, Charles Taylor, calls social imagination. Now, by social imagination, I mean, and you guys can ask more questions about this in a second if I need to parse this out more, but by social imagination, I mean how we spontaneously view the world without really ever thinking about it. These are the cultural assumptions that we don't really reason to, but we just take for granted because, to use a metaphor, it's simply the air we breathe. So let me give you, imagine with me this for a second. Imagine that after we got done with this series, I taught a Zoom marriage and dating course. And I began very quickly into the course advocating for every family who had teenagers or below in the church to start practicing arranged marriages. Now, just to be clear, because sometimes on Zoom, I am not suggesting that, okay? That's not what I'm suggesting tonight. But let's just imagine that I did. What kind of reactions would I receive? Probably just, this is strange and we need to stop this. What is he saying? But then all of a sudden I say, well, hey, you know, this whole, the way the Western culture is doing this doesn't seem to be working very good. I've thought it out. And all of a sudden, what you would have to do is you would have to begin to do what? Well, you would just call me names and get me fired. But you might would have to at that point say, okay, I actually have to think through this because I've been born in a society where this is simply how we do courtship or dating and marriage. And now you're suggesting something else and you've thought it through. And so now I've got to actually think through my assumptions, my kind of inherited social imagination about what courting and dating should and shouldn't look like. Because that's not even on my grid of possibility for my kids, for many of us. Now, of course, if I did the same course in a traditional society, or, you know, maybe 1,000 years ago, or still today in a traditional society, and I started advocating for arranged marriage, they would look at me like, yeah, duh, that's how we do things. And if I was trying to convince them that, no, you should let your children have freedom to choose this, that's better for these reasons, I would really have a probably tough argument against them. That they would not accept that too easily. And my point here isn't, again, to convince you on, you know, how you should marry off your kids. My point is to say we've often inherited a kind of social imagination, not just about our practices, but about the world, about, you know, about a lot of things that we haven't thought our way to, we've assumed. Let me give you another example that's a little bit more on point to what we're talking about in the course, which is, you know, in the ancient world, angels and demons were just assumed. But today in our social imagination, if you're a Westerner and you do believe in angels and demons, in many of our kind of workplaces, in many of our kind of places of public life, you know, you might kind of feel the kind of pressure not to bring that up. Yes, I believe it, but I don't want people to look at me like I'm crazy. And if a senator got up during the hearings going on this week for the Supreme Court and said, hey, an angel came to me and I had this vision that we should, you know, we should pass this or we should deny this confirmation, people would say, no, you can't. What are you doing, right? That's not within their plausibility structure, within the kind of social imaginary. And I'm saying that, of course, for instance, when Augustine wrote City of God, when he was arguing against non-Christians, he could still talk about demons because even the non-Christians believe in demons. So he didn't have to argue for that. He could just assume it and then go from there. So my point here is that what is viewed as reasonable is often in part made up of what our inherited social imagination is. Now, this makes being winsome mean that it doesn't just hinge on basic logic, or it doesn't just hinge on kind of believing to understand, although it's tied with that, but it's what's our current culture's social imagination and how do we engage that? How do we actually cause them to think through their assumptions? I think in order to get at this, the next question then becomes, how do we inherit our social imagination? If we don't simply reason our way to social imaginaries, how do we absorb them? And this is, again, I'm building off the work of the philosopher Charles Taylor here, and he says this. He says, he actually sees this connection between social imagination, and story. And he says, I adopt the term imaginary because my focus is on the way ordinary people imagine their social surroundings. And that's important because most people, we're going to talk about kind of the big mega stories and worldviews a bit tonight, but most people aren't going around thinking on those on those terms. Most people have inherited a social imagination, and they just assume it. But because they assume those things, there are certain things about Christianity when we present it to them that just seems implausible and far-fetched. But then he goes on in this quote. He says, imagine their social surroundings. And this is often not expressed in theoretical terms. In other words, not a grand philosophical package, but it's carried in images and stories and legends. In other words, we tell stories and embed it in those stories. And legends and images is a social imaginary. Now again, why is this point so important? Well, oftentimes, and I'll get to the Lewis quote in a second, but it's important because oftentimes people assume that the first two components that I gave you about rationality, thinking and maybe believing, are just it. They assume reasonable people simply use basic logic and evidence. So that's not actually what's going on. In answering the big questions of life, of course, basic logic and evidence are important, but those basic logic and evidence are often interpreted, or I would say basically always interpreted when we're talking about the big questions of life. They're interpreted within a bigger, larger framework that we receive both through the dominant cultural meta-narratives, the big stories our culture tells, and our social imagination. So then the question is, then what do we do? What do we do at that point? How do we engage people, given that it's not just that we can drop some evidence in here and then walk away, but it's their whole imagination that they've inherited. In other words, they've been closed off because I talked about the shifts last week in culture, because there's this shift so that now they're closed off to a divine realm. They've absorbed this social imagination that says, this world is all we should live for. If there's going to be justice, we better get it here and now, okay? Because this is all we got. If we're going to have happiness and joy, we better get it now. And so they've absorbed a vision of the world that says there is no divine realm. This is all we have. And then there is no transcendent moral framework built into the universe. So we've got to look in, we're making the rules. We got to look inside of us and decide what's true. So these are just part of kind of the social imaginary that we've closed off a divine realm. We've closed off a transcendent morality. So then what do we do? How do we engage? How do we push into their social imaginary? Well, I think this is where C.S. Lewis, I'm assuming most of you have at least heard of Lewis. Lewis was the great British medievalist and apologist who was an atheist for many, many years until he met J.R.R. Tolkien and some others, and he began to see that really his imagination began to wake up. And he started asking questions like, well, what if this is actually not just a myth, but the true myth? Of course, Lewis went on to be really probably the leading apologist of the 20th century, but I think one of the things that's happened is he leaves these little hints for an approach, but people haven't actually given a kind of model by which people can use his approach. And I'm not just pulling from Lewis, I'm pulling from a lot of sources here, but I think he's really helpful. And for Lewis, we needed to break into people's imagination, this inherited imaginative framework by which people interpret the evidence and by which people use logic. But he recognizes if they're just interpreting evidence and they're just using logic, if their imagination's already closed off to the gospel story, then we have to do something to get into their imagination. And he, in this famous lecture, it's called The Weight of Glory, he makes a case for that our deepest pleasures in this life are the gateway into kind of transforming our social imaginations. As Lewis put it, what we need is the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. He's giving this speech, and he gives that line in this address, and then he stops, and he says this: "Do you think I'm trying to weave a spell? Perhaps I am, but remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantments as well as for inducing them. And you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness, which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years. In other words, what Lewis is saying is our imaginations have been closed up, and it is through these deepest aspirations that we have, these deepest joys that we have, that actually serve as these kind of signposts that point beyond themselves and can wake people up. And so what I want to suggest, and this is the third part of this broad heading here, is that one of the ways we go about this, taking some cues here from Lewis, is to learn the features of personhood, what I call the universal features of personhood, that are basically universal. No matter if you, what I'm saying is, no matter if you believe in God or you don't, we pretty much all will have certain features. In other words, okay, not getting into kind of, these kind of scientific theories and these big complex things about how can you use this scientific theory to prove God or something like that. In other words, what I'm suggesting here is that all humans, even if they don't believe in God, will love. They were made to love. They will love. We will live as moral agents. We will assign meaning. We will sense beauty. We will long to find hope. We will worship something. And I think the thing we have to do is we have to learn, and what I want us to learn to do is to put our fingers on these in conversations and say, okay, what's really valuable? You love, you find this meaning in this world, you sense beauty in the world. Now, what story best makes sense of that? Given that even if we deny morality, we will live by some kind of moral code and expect others to do the same. In other words, someone might deny God and say, there is no God, there is no transcendent morality, and yet they still live like there is. They're the first person to stick their finger out of their car and give them the middle finger when someone cuts them off. In other words, even if they deny transcendent morality, they live like there is some kind of code above us. And so I'm wanting to ask the question, and I think we have to learn to ask the question, what story about the world best makes sense of this? So this is what John Polkinghorne of Cambridge University, he's a professor of mathematical physics, when you hear a title like that, you think a kind of, some advanced equation is coming, but this is what Polkinghorne says. He says, the theist and the atheist alike survey the same world of human experience, for offer incompatible interpretations of it. My claim would be that theism has a more profound and comprehensive understanding to offer than that afforded by atheism. And I love this line here. Atheists are not stupid. We need to admit that there are unbelievers, there are atheists who are very smart. But, and I agree with Pokinghorn too, I mean, they explain less. Their story about the world explains less. Although atheism might seem simpler conceptually, it treats beauty and morals and worship as some form of cultural or social brute facts, which accords ill with the seriousness with which these experiences touch on us as persons. And so I think the way we can have these conversations is to talk about these serious experiences we have as humans and then say, what story about the world best explains this? To be able to say, to listen to someone and then say, this is how Christianity makes sense of beauty. This is how Christianity, for me, makes sense of morality. You should try this on. You should see how this fits. This is what Lewis is getting at when he says famously, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So that's my first kind of big point, and I'm going to stop here for a few minutes. My first big point here is to say we've got to understand who we are as humans, who we're talking to. And then with that, once we do that, we see that the way we make big decisions is actually, you know, not only evidence and logic, but also our social imaginary. And then learning how to step into that using these key features of personhood. And I want to stop there and pull up the chat and see if you guys have questions. I see there's a few. It seems like coming in. Yeah, somebody was pointing out here, I'm just summarizing their question, but it's, you know, I think one of the challenges is that people aren't familiar with the Bible. And so they don't have kind of, they're missing some evidence. In other words, they don't actually have the Bible, and they're biblically illiterate, basically. And so if you begin to talk to them, that they don't even have the evidence in some sense. And I think that that's really an important point to make. When you're talking to someone, number one, you can't assume that they necessarily understand the Bible, know the biblical storyline. But I also think that that's a real opportunity because when somebody encounters Christianity and recognizes that, you know, pretty quick they kind of begin to pick up they don't actually know that much about Christianity, then I think there's a real opportunity there rather than oftentimes people think they do know and they've already got their mind made up. So of course, there's some challenges there because you've got to start back and be able to talk to them and explain some things, but I see some real opportunities in that case as well. And that's competing stories. So what I want to do now is say, okay, well, there's these macro stories about the world that shape how people then obviously view the world. And so if we're saying we're going to listen to somebody and we're going to say, hey, what's your view on the world? What are some stories that might come up? Now, I just want to say that as I'm about to give these, a lot of times the people you talk to, maybe they haven't thought about this so clearly, but here are some kind of live options of things that they might have learned in college if they're more theologically or philosophically minded that they've kind of put together. It's certainly things that are hovering around. So I want to give you three macro stories, recognizing that not always people don't always have coherent macro stories, and I'll get to that point in just a second. So one is the pessimistic story. Let me describe this. The pessimistic story says the universe came into existence through a big bang billions of years ago with no divine calls or purpose for future inhabitants. Now notice, let me just back up. I think there's, through these, I'm not going to give much commentary at this point. I just want you to hear this story. I'm not going to say, well, they're wrong here. And there's certain things I think that we could affirm at different parts of the story, but we're going to We'll get to that in later talks. But the universe came into existence through a big bang billions of years ago with no divine cause or purpose for future inhabitants. Eventually, in one small corner of an immense universe, on the planet we call Earth, life began to emerge from chemicals. After a long, unguided evolutionary history, billions of years in the making, which was characterized by natural selection and the survival of the fittest, Homo sapiens eventually emerged. While in the past, humans embraced fanciful projections of deities, illusions of life after death, the rehearsal of sacred rituals, and a transcendent moral order, the use of reason and scientific discovery has awakened those who have the fortitude to face the harsh realities of a universe of natural causes and physical matter. In other words, this is all there is, folks. And the brave ones will admit it. There's a coming of age kind of part of this narrative. Unfortunately, the human cowardice to face the fact that we are alone in the universe and to naively insist on maintaining values grounded in disproven myths continues to play even apparently secular societies. So it's saying, hey, our main, you hear a problem here. A problem is we're still beholden to these ancient myths. That's our big problem. A true unflinching commitment to follow the story to its end leads the pessimistic secular to conclude that life has no ultimate significance. There is no cosmic order, no ethical order outside of our subjective preferences, no universal moral obligations, and even many would maintain no true free will. Our actions are simply a product of our physical makeup and external stimuli. Reason leads to a grim reality. Humanity will go extinct and the solar system itself will as well. Eventually, everything will run out of energy. No one will be alive to even remember history. Ultimately, it will not matter that we existed. Our lives, if you're brave enough to face the truth, must be lived under the cloud of tragedy and absurdity. So, eat, drink, and be merry, right? For tomorrow we die. And there's no meaning to it. There's no significance. And so we would be best off if we simply gave up on those things. Now, you can see why this is a tough pill for most to swallow. I don't encounter on the street too many, or in my neighborhood, too many pessimistic seculars. And if you push them a bit, it'll become evident that they're not being consistent with this. So I won't get into too much of my critique at this point. But the second is the optimistic secular story. So this story begins much like the pessimistic secular account. At the beginning of the universe emerged out of natural causes. Eventually, against all odds, the physical conditions on a particular planet emerge as suitable for the beginning of life. And then you have evolutionary process that favored the survival of the fittest. For most of human history, our ancestors again explained the world by appealing to divine order, assuming enchanted existence. And so you see, this is basically starting off like the other story. But, and again, in this story, through reason and science, enlightenment human beings have cast off myths and deities, and we have come of age. But where it diverges here from that pessimistic story is, unlike its secular counterpart, which sees a godless world as a cold reality that you must heroically face, this story, the optimistic story, says this means there is no God, there are no gods, and that means that we're liberated. And that's exhilarating. We've escaped these kind of mythological conceptions of the world. We've escaped the authoritarian dogma that's plagued us. And now we can, individually or collectively, we can make our own meaning. We can set our own course. So as rational beings, we're set free from kind of our cultural captivity of religion. We can now rise even above evolutionary forces of individual or tribal survival for the purpose of human flourishing. And so we can set out on a quest to maximize pleasure and to minimize pain. We can set out on a quest to treat all people with dignity, to create systems for equal treatment of all, and taking personal responsibility to care for the earth and make it a better place. Yeah, they'll say, you know, we will one day die, but through no doing of our own and no plan of a divine being, we now find ourselves not only on as the actors in the story, but we're the authors of the story. We have the freedom to write the story for ourselves and to pursue meaning and happiness on our own terms. Let me give you the last one here, and that's the story of pluralistic and moral therapeutic spirituality. You would think I could have been creative enough to come up with a shorter title, but there you have it. And this one actually, I think, cuts closest to home for many of us, because it often traffics in under the guise of Christianity. This story, I want to emphasize, is actually distinct from Christianity, but it's also very distinct from the previous two secular stories. This story doesn't necessarily discount those kind of secular models for the emergence of life. God, or at least some kind of divine force, though, is still essential here. They would still say, yes, I believe in God. God gives life meaning. God gives maybe some kind of morality. He wants you to at least be good and gives significance to life. However, neither God, morality, nor purpose is found by looking outside into kind of the world or into some kind of religious authority or the fabric of the universe, natural law, as some traditions call it, or in the church. No, that's not how we get our moral code. That doesn't ultimately give us where we find significance and meaning. While ancient religions may provide, they would say, some helpful wisdom for life today, the outdated portions of such teachings should be adapted to our modern world. Ultimately, we are to look inside of ourselves to the unique human, or maybe even the divine spark that lives within each of us. And that's how we live authentic lives. God exists, or at least some kind of divine force, yes, exists, but exists to help us find our true potential, feel better about ourselves. This God exists to guide us to treat others kindly. But this isn't the God of the Bible. This isn't a God who calls us to turn and repent. This is a very different God than Christianity, is what I want to emphasize. But oftentimes, the people we talk to will have this kind of vague belief in God while packaging it in this kind of therapeutic form, where God is kind of like an uncle who's always there to kind of pat you on the back and tell you good job. Now, I think what actually happens is when we're talking to people, you will, again, rarely have somebody unpack it like I just did for you. But it's still there because these are dominant narratives. Even if they couldn't articulate it, at times these are kind of looming in the background. But I also want to say that not only are these macro stories there, we also have these what I would call micro stories. These are stories are more assumed because they're the little stories we hear every day, but they still become kind of the script by which people live their lives. And I'll just briefly mention these. And by the way, because of how we are today, oftentimes we're combining these. And often someone will hold to one of those macro stories, or they'll articulate part of that while still actually living out one of these scripts I'm about to give you. Or even as Christians, we can say the creeds, we can affirm what we believe about God, and yet actually live our lives based on these stories. And so one is the story of achievement. You are what you accomplish. Now, we're rarely explicitly told this but we don't have to be explicitly told this. The message is loud and clear. You know, from the expensive study sessions to get a leg up on standardized testing for our kids, to the need to always be winning, the celebrity culture of, you know, that paints the picture of what real success looks like. All of these are part of kind of a collective story we hear and that people will base their life on. That real life is about, or the good life, the meaning of life is about achievement, about personal achievement, or the story of consumerism. I mean, from our car commercials to movies to media, the default story for so many people in our culture is if you achieve that kind of financial success, that is the good life. That's the meaningful life. And I'm telling you these because they're oftentimes telling themselves this story, and then they're clinging to their work and they're pumping 80 hours, you know, they're doing 80, 90 hour work weeks. They've achieved so much. And then their life is actually falling apart. And when you're talking to someone, you can recognize they've embraced the story of consumerism and it's really clear it's not working. And one more mention here is the story of romance. And that's, you know, once you find your soulmate, then life will be good. And this is Philip Reeve, a philosopher and thinker, talked about this with when we lost God, what happened in Western culture is we put in kind of romance as the kind of savior. And so from Beauty and the Beast to Taylor Swift songs, I mean, we're told that happily ever after is found with true love's kiss. And so what I'm saying is learning these micro stories and these macro stories and just being aware, you can't assume that someone's embraced all of this, but being aware of kind of the storylines and having them as kind of mental registers will actually help you and help you as I'm about to give you a kind of format called Inside Out to have these conversations. They'll help you better to enter into their stories and ask questions, knowing some of the narratives that they might have embraced, either that they're aware of or even unwittingly. So I'm seeing I am low on time tonight. So I wanna do one more thing here. And I tell you what, I'm gonna start with the Christian story next week. But I want to give you the model for how to enter in to these stories, because that's going to become the kind of approach that we're using. And so for the next 5 weeks, we'll take a particular kind of way, kind of how someone's imagining the world. And we'll talk about, okay, how can we approach a conversation about meaning? How can we approach a conversation about significance? And we're going to use this model to do it. So we'll come back and I'll lead with a Christian story. I think a lot of you being members at HTC know the story of creation, fall, redemption, and recreation. I wanted to go through it and we will next week, but I want to make sure we land on this before we go tonight. And that's called Inside Out. And so Inside Out is, it helps us take these theoretical insights that I've been giving and then kind of go into everyday conversation. And it begins with inside the person's worldview that we're talking to, or their story, their social imagination. And it's critical that we do that, rather than saying, hey, simply, I want to talk to you about Christianity. Instead, we begin by going into their world and asking them about their story. Where do they find meaning? Where do they find significance? What do you love to do? Why do you love to do it? You know, having these, attending to that person as a human and having these types of conversations. And as you're doing that, here's some questions. So you're entering into their world in a kind of incarnational way. You're attending to them as human beings and you're asking the question in your mind, and this guides my conversations. What can I affirm and what will, maybe not right away, what will I need to challenge? What are some major things they're saying that's going to be problematic, that doesn't sit well with the gospel, doesn't conform to reality? So what can I affirm about what they're saying? and what can I challenge? And I think it's important that when we have these kind of overlaps in the stories that we live by, somebody says, you know, I love my family. I think that's something to affirm. Like, we don't have to denigrate that. I think one of the things we have to talk about, though, with family or anything that we love is what happens when you make that the ultimate thing, okay? But family is a good thing, and other things, like I love my work, or, you know, and so in these conversations, what can I affirm? But then at the same time, what do I need to challenge? What do I need to ask more questions about? And then as they're telling the story, the other thing I'm thinking about is, where does this story lead? And is it internally consistent and livable? Let me give you a quick example. I think one of the things that's going on is there's lots of conversations, and rightly so, in my opinion, about justice. And I think we should learn to enter those conversations and be patient and hear the hurt and the pain and the thing and the experiences that people have. I think when people come in, though, from a secular standpoint, when they're saying, I'm not a Christian, and they're talking about justice, one of the things that I eventually want to get to is, yes, but where is our standard of justice? In other words, if you're adopting one of those first two secular positions about the world, then there is no ultimate standard of justice. Where do we go? It's just your emotional or preferences about morality versus this person's preference about morality. And so, in other words, I want to affirm, yes, that there's something deeply the matter with the world. Again, that's something I can affirm. I also can affirm that we should care about justice. I also want to end the conversation, just ask, you know, tell me where you get your standard of justice. Because I think there are these deep aspirations, this desire for things to be made right. And I think that's part of what it means to be human, to feel that there's something not wrong. That there's something not right with the world. It gets to this feature of personhood, that we're here and yet something seems wrong. But then I want to kind of put my finger on that and say, yeah, but I agree with you. I affirm that. But this story that you're telling yourself about the world, those two things don't go together. It's inconsistent. If you play that out, in other words, it's not livable. And we can do this with love. We can do this with all those features, and we will do this in the coming weeks, with all those features of personhood. And to say, you know, I really appreciate what you're saying, but I think there's some things that are off here. And actually, I find the Christian story to make a lot better sense of these aspirations. I find the Christian story to actually make sense of what you're longing for, but doesn't make sense on the story you're living. And so this is this opportunity to once we've listened, we've been patient, we've asked questions, to then say, okay, now let me ask you to just consider this. Consider how Christianity helps me understand this tension that you're feeling. Now, granted, we're the ones who brought up the tension, but that was intentional because we want to kind of clear some elbow space, a little space for them to begin to think, well, maybe what if this whole Christianity thing, maybe what if there's something to it? And one of the things as you're doing that is to look where their story, these competing stories, borrow from the Christian story. In other words, I think you can make the case, I'll just use that example for the sake of time, about justice. I can make a case, and we'll talk about this more in coming sessions, that actually these longings for justice, there is this human longing for something to be made right, but the conceptions of justice that we have, that the rich should care for the poor, and that we should do that, is actually borrowing for certain key themes of the Christian story that have been embedded in Western culture. And that's really important to say, hey, look, you're actually saying something that's true, but I think it actually makes sense on our story, and in fact, in the ancient world, you would have never had a kind of, you know, you would have never had a kind of protest against, you know, in the way you're thinking about doing it, or the way that you're thinking about justice. You wouldn't have had that in the ancient world. It was actually Christianity that brought that historically. And then how does the Christian narrative better address our experiences and observations of the world? And here again, it's just saying, using creation, fall, redemption, and recreation to say, hey, you're saying something that's true, but I think the Christian narrative actually better explains that. So what I want to do in the next 5 weeks is to dive in to these really practical ways to do it. Now that I've introduced this, we'll use this framework every week, inside, outside. Okay, how do we start in this conversation? How can this be a kind of mental scaffolding for conversation? And then this is, by the way, what I use as I'm thinking about application for preaching. Because the reality is we've absorbed all these stories. And so when I'm kind of diving in, I'm giving you behind the scenes hints of how I think about it. When I'm diving in, trying to do application, I'm thinking, what story have we all even embraced, and how is that not working? And then how does the Christian story better make sense of this? How does it change the way we view life? So this is actually fundamental to how I preach and teach, and also how I've learned to have conversations both in discipleship with Christians and non-Christians, this kind of inside out. So we'll be using it every week, and I hope by the end, you adopt the approach for yourself and it becomes a kind of grid that you constantly come back to.